Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Eat Your Words and Heritage Radio Network. It's a very hot day in Brooklyn. It's about 90-some degrees, and I'm really glad for one that I'm not sitting or standing in a kitchen right now in a restaurant, perhaps behind those pizza ovens here at Roberta's, and thankfully in an air-conditioned radio station. So my guest today, going back a little bit, we've heard a number of industries that are struggling with gender disparity, perhaps business, tech, and this book happens to chronicle and really examine very closely the gender inequality of women chefs in the professional kitchens. So my guest today has written a book called Taking the Heat, Women Chefs and Gender Inequality in the Professional Kitchen. She is an associate professor of sociology at Texas State University, and she's on the line. It's Deborah Harris. How are you?
Hi, Kathy. Hi, I'm fine.
Thank you so much, and really wonderful, interesting, eye-opening, and exhaustive study that you've written here, along with your co-author, Patty Gouffray. Let me just talk a little bit about yourself, because you're studying sociology. What brought you to the professional kitchen industry?
Well, I wish I had a more sort of academic answer, but I was really inspired by Top Chef.
Yeah.
So a few years ago, when I was first starting out as a professor, one of my little rituals is I would always sit down and watch Top Chef whenever it was on. And I wasn't a huge foodie, but I just remember really clearly one year when they're in Miami, they did one of those little those cooking challenges where they did the fake out on the chefs, as they do on that show, if you've ever watched it. And they told them, hey, we're not going to cook tonight for Top Chef. You guys are going to go out. We're going to treat you to a night on the town. So everyone got dressed up. Turned out it was a surprise, and they're actually taking them to cook at some food trailers outside of some nightclubs.
Okay.
And so you had all these chefs, you know, in their going out clothes, having to run through supermarkets, plan menus. And at that point, a woman hadn't won, but there are three women left in the competition for that season, and they're all really angry about having to cook while wearing makeup and wearing high heels. And wow. I just remember one of the women chefs saying, I never let my male colleagues see me this way. And I thought that's so strange, but then it occurred to me that, you know, hey, in a male-dominated job, I bet, you know, being very feminine might make you not fit in, and so that could be a problem. And that led me to think, you know, hey, I don't know of any women chefs. I could name a few men chefs, even though I wasn't a foodie, but I couldn't think of any women. And when I approached my colleague, Patty Gouffray, about this, we started talking and saying, you know, if there's any job that you think women would be able to sort of burst through and, you know, get a foothold in, you'd think it would be cooking, because you think of that being a woman's job at home.
Yeah, you'd think so.
Yeah, but it's actually pretty rare. Only about 20% of head and executive chefs are women.
I thought that was really eye-opening because, you know, in this, surrounded by foodies and, you know, the gastronom, whatever, media, food, and so forth, you know, we see a lot of female chefs here and there, but I don't think anyone's that surprised that there are fewer female head chefs or chef de cuisine than male in America. But I thought it was really interesting that you found out that there's even a fewer ratio of those than there are female CEOs in business.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's so much, you know, with the whole sort of Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In.
Yeah.
There's been so much attention to women's underrepresentation in the boardroom And strangely enough, there's actually more women in the boardroom than the kitchen when you look professionally.
That's just strange. Yeah. And so obviously, like, there's been a lot of strides in business professions, but in kitchens, it seems like a really backward sort of place.
Yeah.
So obviously this book is a long examination of the answers to that, but would you be able to perhaps in like, I don't know, 3 or 4 bullet points, like kind of point out some of the main reasons for that?
Yeah, well, one of the things is that there's just not one reason, mm-hmm. which makes it kind of hard to address. One is just the history of the career itself. You know, early chefs had to really, you know, we're talking about the French nobility, they had to set themselves apart from the cooking of women.
Okay.
So that sort of set up this culture where men's cooking is seen as better. And then today what we see is that there's a lot of just very male-dominated kitchen cultures, and that makes it hard for women to fit in, like, and to become leaders.
Like in the workplace itself,
the
working culture.
Yeah, the individual restaurant. Huh. Yeah. Very macho culture.
Yeah.
And then the final thing we found that was really interesting, and then that macho culture also so plays into the media and who gets the most press,
right.
which, you know, is really useful for your career. And then finally, which is that it's a career that's really difficult to balance work and family. And because women tend to take on more of the family responsibilities, it's really incompatible to work the hours and for the pay and the benefits that most chefs work for. And still be a mom and have a family.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, that sounds very, very clear when you break it down that way. So you also write in the beginning, the introduction, that there was a female-focused chef awards that was introduced in 2013, and then a lot of people took to Twitter to criticize it because, you know, why should we have a separate award for the best chef, the best female chef? Like, isn't that insulting, like calling somebody a lady scientist or something like that?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. Do you feel now, after doing all the research that you have, that is a positive thing? Or?
You know, that's a really great question. You know, when I first started, I definitely see that. I love your example of, you know, best lady scientist, which sounds really funny. You know, I think we would all cringe at that. But you know, as we looked into this, I think, you know, we came away with, for a lot of times when women are in, not just chefs, but when women are in other male-dominated fields, there's so much pressure to sort of go after the male model and try to fit into that and to try to assimilate and, you know, defeminize and, you know, try to make sure that people don't see you as different. And that can be helpful, but there also is something to be said about sort of embracing the idea that, yeah, there are women chefs and maybe they can be different in some ways, you know, but that could be a positive. And we found that, you know, especially with being a chef, a creative career, the media is so powerful these days and the opportunities that are afforded to chefs. So I think those awards are good because at the end of the day, you are getting media attention. You know, you are getting people to hear about your food and hear about your cooking and make them want to come and learn more. So I think, you know, when you're looking at both the business and the artistic part of being a chef, I think attention is good attention.
Right,
you know,
even
if it's a gender-specific award.
Right. Now, you write that early on, sort of in like the French gastronomical days, the times of Briettes or Escoffier and so forth, a lot of the writing was done by men itself. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the food media today? Do you think that has any... Well, it has, I'm sure, a lot of impact on which chefs we celebrate, but did you find anything, about the breakup of men and female food media members?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think we don't really necessarily look at what the chefs themselves are creating, but some of the things we just come across is, again, that men tend to be sort of shown as sort of the masters and the educators, and that does, you know, date back to sort of the French chefs of the aristocracy, you know, sort of showing that, you know, we know so much and we're going to educate people. We tend to see women chefs and just women writing in food in general, it tends to take more of a softer approach, more of the, you know, I'm not the expert up on this pedestal, but more like, let me teach you something, you know, let me show you something, let me share something with you.
Right.
Instead of the, I'm this expert, you know, worship at my feet thing.
Oh, speaking of which, and there was, I love the whole history that you go through of chefs in this book. And I was just, I had like a lightning bolt moment when you wrote in one section. If you don't mind, could I read from it?
Sure, go ahead.
Great. So you write, gender in cooking has been intricately linked for as much of human history that is usually taken form in of women's cooking being associated with routine maternal care work that nourishes family members. In contrast, men's cooking has long been viewed as more high status and important. Some of the first men to cook publicly were men working for ancient Egyptian royalty. This form of cooking was professionalized via the priest class, who engaged in animal sacrifices to their gods involving the preparation and cooking of meat. These priests were able to link their food handling and preparation to the divine and garner powerful positions in society. Therefore, their cooking was given special status and was elevated above the ordinary, everyday cooking of women. And I was just blown away because, you know, thinking about this more special kind of ritualized cooking for sacrifice, not necessarily to sustain people. It just reminds me of a lot of things about haute cuisine, which they're not necessarily to, you know, a tasting course menu at per se or something like that isn't really meant to make you survive and not hungry.
Yeah, it is. Well, I mean, that's, I think that's a great parallel. I mean, it is meant to be an occasion and a special elevated thing versus, you know, the everyday, you know, getting food on the table.
So the loftier sort of purpose behind the cooking is has separated the gender, I guess, the gendered cooking throughout the ages.
Yeah, I mean, and it really did help early chefs. I mean, you have to think about the earliest chefs. They're just seen as servants. I mean, they really were not seen as, oftentimes they're drafted out of the military. So they weren't seen as what we see chefs today as these new rock stars. And so they had to really work at getting status to their job. You know, so a lot of what they had to do is put down sort of the work, the everyday work of women cooking in the home, so that what they were doing was seen like, you know, that's this everyday thing. Women do it out of love for their family because they have to. We do this art. We do this thing that's educated, and you need special training and apprenticeships. You know, it's very different from everyday cooking. And so that helped bring up chefs, you know, along sort of the occupational hierarchy. But at the same time, it really denigrated women's cooking. And sort of that sort of stain got onto women who wanted to cook professionally. They would still be associated with the home cooking that's not very valued.
So interesting. And you know, it is true that it's only a few, I don't know, like a couple generations away that we didn't have such celebrity chefs in the media like we do today. So this study is actually fairly new, although you do write about one of the first celebrity chefs in France around the 17th or 18th century, and a man named Carrier, or
we talk about Carrier and his work with, you know, again, there were chefs were seen as servants, but there were a few that had these loftier sort of, you know, let's look at myself as being someone who, you could create these wonderful artistic things. And so Carrier's work was very much these beautiful showpieces. I mean, it would take, you know, dozens of underchefs for him to do these creations. You know, very different from what we see today because, you know, with the work of Escoffier, which is sort of a, you know, followed Carrier's work, so Auguste Escoffier, he was more about, let's come up with these, you know, menus that are replicable, that we could replicate and have in a restaurant and actually, you know, get some butts in the seats and serve them every night. And so we've seen this big movement from these big grand things to also the idea of chefs marrying the idea of being both an artist and a business person.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, reading about Carrier's story, it sounded like he was a guy who really took himself seriously and believed in something that he wanted to prove that didn't really exist before. And I wonder if a woman would have even had that position to try to take her work seriously in in cuisine. And, you know, if anyone would hear, I wonder if there was mm-hmm. anyone out there like yeah. who just didn't get recorded or something.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were women doing, you know, wonderful cooking, but at the time, you know, so much of, and one of the reasons we know these men's names is that they were able to write books, mm-hmm. And some of them that are still read today. But women were not, as I said earlier, you know, writing these books where they were these experts. And so some of these early French chefs, you know, some of the work that they did, you know, they're able to sort of capitalize on their knowledge and say, okay, sometimes we can. So they would even write some books that were meant to educate these women, you know, these sort of simple home cooks of mm-hmm. women.
Gosh.
So, yeah, it would have been really hard, I think, because of the, you know, just the gender
wow.
Arrangements at that time.
So yeah. many parallels to today, and it's really yeah. fascinating to look at how this inequality throughout the ages has really manifested in what we're mm-hmm. seeing today in the workforce.
Yeah.
Much to be talked about, but we're going to cut to a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with you, Deborah.
You are listening to The Landing. This is called Write It Down. This is Eat Your Words on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words, and my guest today is Deborah A. Harris, the author, co-author of Taking the Heat. So, Deborah, this book, you write a lot of things that kind of surprised me and kind of made me a little disappointed in ourselves as a food media.
Okay.
So, you know, the idea in one section you talk about no great women chefs, mm-hmm. you know, this feeling that it seems to be a little bit pervasive amongst the food media, that giving more coverage to women chefs would be seen as sexist. And, you know, if there's no great chefs that happen to be women, then we're not going to force it and write about them or have as much representation. And that was expressed by a couple of, editors that you spoke to. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, we didn't actually speak to the editors. These were mm-hmm. Statements they had made in other media outlets.
Okay, to journalists, right.
Yeah. This all came about from a couple of years ago. Time Magazine did a Gods of Food issue.
Mm-hmm.
And as the name implies, it was a lot of men and really basically no coverage of women chefs at all.
Right.
Yeah, and then when they're kind of called out about it, a lot
right.
of people sort of, you know, jumped on that, and they called them out, and they defended themselves. They and other publications, you know, said, listen, you know, we don't want to sort of pander or treat women,
mm-hmm.
you know, we don't want to give them that special treatment. If people were talking about women chefs, we'd definitely cover them, but they were really ignoring just the ways that these networks, you know, if they're very much one gender, you know, mm. if everyone works together and you see the same names being sort of popped up again and again and again, it's, you really don't ever see anyone different. And so these women sort of get ignored, you know, in that process.
It brings up a really tricky, I guess, debate, mm-hmm. which goes
yeah.
back to celebrating. Should we celebrate women chefs as a separate entity mm-hmm. Than men? Because, you know, it brings up, you know, should we judge on basically the quality of the food as we deem it? Or maybe that view is slanted after all we've learned about the different attitudes of the cooking styles, I guess, haute mm-hmm. versus home throughout the years. It's so ingrained, it seems,
mm-hmm.
in the roles. So...
Yeah.
It's interesting to see how that has reflected today.
Mm-hmm.
So also reading this book, there's a lot of talk about how difficult it is for women in the workplace and trying to stand up and assert yourself in the kitchen. and not be seen as girly or bitchy or mom-like. Mm-hmm. Sounds very similar to, well, I didn't actually read Lean In, but I, you know, read a lot about it.
Yeah.
I mean, would you say that this is a very similar, struggle that is happening for women, of being seen and recognized and not being stereotyped as certain very unflattering types?
Yeah, we talked to some of the women chefs themselves, and what they say really does align really well with women in all sorts of other fields.
Right.
That you have to, when you become a leader, you know, there's really this fine line. And, you know, if you take on this sort of masculine role that people tend to think of, you know, it's very hierarchical. You know, if you think of someone who's a manager, and if you think of sort of that, you know, hard-line manager who's very hierarchical, who, you know, they're the boss and they sort of tell the orders and you're just supposed to fall in line behind them. You know, women would get really, they're very negatively sanctioned that way. You know, mm-hmm. then they would get labeled as being bitchy. But then if they tried to be a kinder, nicer boss, you know, they could get walked over very much and people wouldn't respect them.
Yep.
So it was really, so that really aligns really well with a lot of other research.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, and the women themselves were aware of this, and it was, and it also becomes this almost other type of labor that they have to do. I mean, as you're doing all the multiple things you have to do as a chef, from, you know, cooking to management to press, all the other, you know, 100 things that's running through your mind at one time, after you've been standing on your feet for 12 hours. These women also had to think about, well,
politics.
When I told that guy to get this dish, did I sound like a bitch? Like,
oh my gosh.
This extra sort of layer that women have to work with that men, you know, don't have to worry about censoring themselves as much.
Wow. So it's like over, it's even more work. That they have to overcome. So you did talk to, in creating your research, you did a extensive content analysis, as you mentioned, about pieces of journalism in the public, publications, that is. And you also interviewed more than 30 female chefs who have had a role of an executive or a head chef. Mm-hmm. How did you find these folks? Just curious.
Well, the majority of ones, so we were doing qualitative research. So we were really not trying to do a big survey of women chefs because that would be really hard to find them and do that. We really want in-depth information. Like, tell us all throughout your career what had happened and your experiences. And so we started in the area where we are in Texas. And so we started looking at food-related media. So we started looking at restaurant reviews and profiles in papers in Central Texas. And then once we would identify a few women, we'd say, hey, are there other women that you know? And so we'd sort of do what's called a snowball sample. And so they would recommend friends or people they had met professionally. And so that's how we kind of expanded out. So the women are all from Central Texas, but they have a lot of, many of them had worked all over the country. So they're able to speak about things sort of, you know, nationally.
That makes sense. Do you find that there's any women chefs who are particularly navigating the struggles well and might be seen as a role model for, you know, standing up for themselves, gaining respect, and maybe balancing work and life and family a bit?
Well, amongst the women that we talked to, so some of the participants that we spoke with, there are definitely, I mean, I really came away, you know, I came away from this with so much respect for these women. I mean, they do this incredibly physically demanding but very creative job at the same time, and they're so passionate about what they did. I mean, they love food. They lived and breathed food, and they you know, were just so passionate about it. It's hard to walk away without sort of feeling that same level of emotion. So I think the ones that really sort of took this, you know, they're all very strong. And so those were the ones I really admired, the women who came in and were very much, you know, this is who I am, this is my personal, how I feel about things. So even if it'll be rocking the boat a little bit, if I see something like harassment, I'm going to call it out. If I see something like mistreatment, I'm going to call that out. And I really respected the women who said that, you know, when they became management, when they were sort of able to break through and become, you know, executive chefs themselves, that they purposely tried to make a more humane kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tried to be more caring towards their families, of the people that they worked for. basically they would look at their employers, their employees, and they'd say, you're more than just a worker. You also have family needs. And they tried to be cognizant of that. And so I think the women that, they had gone through sort of this hazing process, and they made it a point to say, that's not the way it has to be.
Right.
We can be more cooperative. We don't have to be competitive or macho, and we can, if I get upset with someone, I don't have to throw a pan and scream at someone. I can explain what the problem is and actually train you instead of scream at you.
That sounds like a very successful model, overall, just for any boss.
Yeah. Well, and we found that the women themselves, and I think we see this across the whole industry, not just women. Chefs today, want to be seen as professionals. They don't want to be seen as, a bunch of hash slingers. They want that almost sort of white-collar sort of respect. And so if you're screaming and yelling and throwing food and coming in hungover, you don't get that as much.
Right, absolutely. So I wonder, do you think, or perhaps did any of the women that you interviewed think, that if there were more representation, it was more sort of normal to see female top chefs or head chefs, that they wouldn't have to deal with some of these discrimination and stereotypes that they deal with, they would be more accepted?
Mm-hmm. Well, the women we talked to, they kind of had a love-hate relationship with the depiction of chefs in the media.
Okay.
On one hand, they said that it's really not, the Gordon Ramsays that you see, that's not really reality.
Yeah.
And they also, but on the other hand, though, they also felt like sometimes some of the Food Network shows and things like that, they really showed just the pretty side of being a chef. They didn't talk about the hard labor. So on one hand, they kind of were like, this is not really realistic, but they also were really happy when they would see more women in the media, because they felt that that was bringing more attention to all of them and showing that, women can do this really physically and mentally demanding career.
Yeah, and it's nothing strange. It's hopefully less and less challenging over time. I wanted to ask, how far have we come from these stereotypes? But I realize that it's fairly new, would you say, this phenomenon of, celebrity chefdom in itself, because chefs were seen before as, manual labor. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question would be, where do we go from here? How can we help support more equality in the workplace?
Well, I think what you're saying is correct, is that it is a fairly recent phenomenon, the whole idea of being a celebrity chef. And that actually does have, it offers a lot of opportunities for women, because they can sort of help shape what it means to be a celebrity chef. So I think if women chefs, one of the things we recommend in the book is for women chefs to sort of band together. There are several groups around the country. There's La Danse des Escoffiers, which is a group for women in the culinary field. It's not just about women chefs, but also food writers, et cetera. There's several organizations for women in the culinary field, and if women sort of band together, they can create more of a media presence. They can sort of come together and realize that they're not alone in the things they experience. So some of these networks, the old boy networks, they can kind of create their own through that.
Yep.
And so that can be really good. And as diners, as people who follow the food world, I think, making a point to eat at a restaurant with women chefs. Bloomberg News did some story, and they found that some of the restaurant groups, that if they had more women chefs in these restaurant groups, sort of at the head of these restaurants, they would hire more women themselves. So really, giving a lot of attention and a lot of, giving your business to women like April Bloomfield, who has women working under her and doesn't, buy into this, if there's one woman in the kitchen, there can only be one. so sort of seeking them out and seeing what women have to offer.
Yeah.
Would be great.
That's a really important reminder that we're all part of this sort of tastemakers as the public and by patroning these restaurants, that we all have some measure of helping them succeed and supporting them. And no doubt your book hopefully unveils a lot of those, a lot of issues today. So congrats to that. And hopefully that'll help people understand more the different challenges. One last question, I guess. Do you have any favorite, you just mentioned April Bloomfield, but do you have any favorite sort of pioneering chef de cuisine a lady chef?
You know, myself, I just, I kind of have a little bit of a, I just am enamored with the work. I'm a huge sweet tooth.
Okay.
I have a huge sweet tooth. So, like, Christina Tosi, every couple of months I'll break out something. And then all my friends will get something from, like, one of her recipe books. So
cool.
I love her work, and I have spent many hours trying to replicate them to varying degrees of success.
That is super cool. Great example, too. Very, very creative chef, and I think a lot of people are kind of following her cues in the, world of pastry. So very exciting stuff. All right, Deborah, thank you so much for joining us, and I can't wait to share more insights and over the dinner table as conversation, perhaps, from your book. So thank you so much for investigating this.
Thank you so much for having me.
So nice to have you. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Oh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.